Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates. So, hello. Good morning, Horace. How are you? Nice to see you.
Afternoon, Ben. I'm doing well. It's great to see you as well. It's been a little while since we last caught up.
It has been. These things are awesome. So it's the end of my day, beginning of your day, middle of your day. It's the technology world is a wonderful place. Wonderful place.
You know, it's a world that's always evolving, but then it goes in these cycles. And we can talk about the cycles in a little bit.
It feels
new and familiar all at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think I was thinking about this earlier on as about how to introduce you to the audience, really, and to think about how when I first met you. And I can't remember if I met you in person first or if we did one of these little chats first. And I can't remember. But I've got this little break in my head and it's like pre-COVID, post-COVID. Nothing happened during COVID. And I think you're a post-COVID kind of friend and sort of idea bouncer. That isn't even a term or a word. I've just made it up. Why don't you introduce yourself and sort of say hello to the fans that are out there of Horace?
Well, and hello, fans and audience.
Give us a shout out where you are. What are you doing?
Yeah, sure. A very quick intro of myself. Horace Wu. I am the founder and CEO of a company called Cynthia. We do contract stuff. It's a deal provisions platform that lets people kind of tap into stuff they've done before to inform what they should be doing in the future, which used to be a really novel idea. Now everybody's doing it because of Gen AI. It's one of those fun things where you can kind of see everyone kind of putting their hand up and go, oh, I do this. And you're like, oh, okay, well, this is getting very crowded. I used to be the popular girl in this world. And it's fun though. It's really, really fun because I think everyone's bringing new ideas. And I love this. It's one of those niche problems that everyone like recognizes. And we've had decades to try and solve this. Nobody's really solved it. So I think more ideas is better. But anyway, that's what I do. And in my spare time, what little of it I have, I look after two little monsters. No, one's a monster, the other one's just a little angel. Don't let the older one ever hear this. I love them. And it means rather than, you know, doing fun things in New York, I get to go to playgrounds every weekend.
Nice.
Very, very well.
New York playgrounds. During all of my trips to New York, I've never visited a New York playground. Probably quite rightly, because I wasn't probably with any children. But you know,
there are signs outside some playgrounds that says if you're an adult, you cannot enter unless you're accompanied by a child.
Really?
So Ben, I think yes, there are. I'll send you a photo. So it's a good thing.
It's definitely a good thing. But it's interesting. So one of the first questions I was going to sort of talk about is really what you've already just, how you've just introduced yourself and sort of your platform, which is sort of where we're in this time of Gen AI noise and hubbub and excitement and trepidation and experimentation. And as you say, sort of the problem that your business solves for has been around for a while. In terms of nobody's cracked it, apart from you guys, obviously. But now everyone thinks that there's a chatbot somewhere that can fix it and something else. And I guess, sort of, as you said, it's a good time to be because there's more people talking about the problem, which means there's more people who have an appetite to try and solve it. But do you think that there's sort of that sort of time now where people trying to think, okay, well, there's product out here that they market, they can do it, we can talk to them, but actually we can try and build this ourselves. Is there a sort of a, where do you guys fit amongst the noise? What's your position? How are you thinking about it? Do you ally? Do you sort of bank off the sort of the not the noise? I keep on saying noise. That's a negative sense. I don't mean it like that. Hype. But just the hype that's just out
the
there.
Attention.
Yeah.
Attention. We spent a long time thinking about this strategically. Do you want to go against the wave? Of course not, because you're going to be completely washed over. Do you want to ride the wave like a lot of people have? Do we change our website address to cynthia.ai? No, because that would be terrible. There's a lot of repeated letters there. Or do you do something else with the wave? Because the wave is coming. It's already here. And if you don't do something, the lack of action is a decision in itself. So what we kind of did was we looked at the spectrum of what's in the market and also where the market was going. And what we decided was, well, the maturity of the technology is not quite there yet. Like it's really fun and novel and it can do amazing things, but it's not consistent. It's not predictable. It's not useful in a way that lawyers would be able to kind of rely on this. A good analogy I've been using, which I use a lot less these days than I used to a year ago, is you would use Gen AI to paint you a picture of a house and it would look beautiful, but you wouldn't use Gen AI to draw you a blueprint and then build from that blueprint. Yep. And that's kind of where the technology is. It still is kind of there, although it's getting better at drawing blueprints. And so if you kind of look at where the market's going, is there's a need for really reliable data. There's a need to have that kind of grounding layer. And that's, I don't think, ever going to change. No. Simply by the nature of this generation of generative AI. Now, there might be something in the future, people are working on it, but it's not there yet. So fundamentally, like, what do lawyers need? What do people need? What can we provide? It's that reliable data layer. It's that sort of information that either people can draw on or generative AI can draw. And so we've been thinking about it in that way. And so for us, Gen AI is just a tooling. It's like, okay, well, if we can make use of it for a specific use case that leverages the data we're creating, then sure, absolutely, we are a Gen AI company. But are we going to go out there and release an end-to-end, nothing but a chatbot sort of tool? It doesn't really make sense because, one, everyone can do it, and two, like, that's not valuable to the end users. So that's kind of how we think about it. It's to ride the wave only where it makes sense. Wait for the right wave. Just kind of stay in the surf for a bit longer.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of it's been our approach. I mean, I think you mentioned it, sort of a lack of action or a lack of activity is probably a bad thing. Thinking about things sort of strategically and sort of making an assessment around where you are, what you can do, how readily you can pivot against something. I mean, we've both probably seen different examples of vendors going all in on Gen AI at the expense of what they do for a living type stuff. And there are moments for that, and sort of I'm just a little bit more conservative than that. I sort of, a little bit like you, Gen AI is going to be transformational, but that's a going to be. It's not is yet, in my opinion. And there's lots of great technologies and providers out there, but just changing your website to .ai or putting a button in that can do something doesn't change your value prop. It doesn't do anything. And I think for baby companies like ours, who can't go off and buy CoCounsel for whatever many millions of pounds or whatever it might be, we've got really tough decisions to make around how we deploy our resource and what we focus on and how we go about it. And I think those are considerations that are really important because you're sort of responsible for people and customers and all that sort of stuff. And just going, oh, that looks shiny, and I'll go and play with that thing as a business, unless you think you can monetize it or do something particularly well with it. I think it's a little bit risky.
I think you've nailed it, right? Like the statement that, like, what do customers actually want and need is the primary driver for this. Like I say to my team, there's only two things I care about as a CEO. One is how happy are our customers, and two are how happy are our team members. If I can tick both boxes, I've done my job. I can sleep easy at night. And if we went ahead tomorrow and released a whole suite of Gen AI products, it's not hard. There's open source code for all of this right now. But is that going to serve our customers and solve what they need? Maybe at a stretch. Kind of thinking about the priorities. Like, we're here for the long term, solving what customers need, catching the wave with help with funding, maybe. Yeah. But then where does that get you?
We're the same. I mean, we think and talk about process and workflow automation, and yep. we think about, okay, well, the whole nature of what's out there, typically, and that's not exclusively, but typically you've got chat interfaces that are one-time action. Somebody's going to do something. That doesn't scream process or workflow. It screams a point in a workflow, but somebody's got to go over there and then craft a prompt and do a thing. So we're looking at how we layer, for the right use cases and the right scenarios, make that technology accessible to a process. And so sometimes that means that a human doesn't even need to know that it's Gemini or ChatGPT or whatever that's doing the work. The outcome is what they care about and what they want to get, whether that's a summary or an extraction or a this or a that. It doesn't matter. So that's how we're thinking about it. How can we double down on process and workflow, but think about how we make some of the integration points seamless to the end user? So, yeah, it's one of those tricky, challenging things, because you sort of sat there going, well, I've got a roadmap, and I've got a roadmap as long as my arm. And if I do this, that means that at least some of that arm is getting chopped off and being replaced by something else. Not quite a cyborg moment, but you know, it's starting to think about how things impact sort of what you're doing and the narrative and how you're sort of sat there.
Maybe just a point we can come back to later, but what's interesting about what you say is, like, the latest wave of the hype in the hype is agentic AI, which is to let the large language model create its own steps to then assign to sub language model agents to fulfill those steps and then orchestrate it and fill it. And like in a way that sounds really cool, but then you've got next to no control over that.
Yeah.
So
from a compliance perspective, it's bonkers.
Yeah. I know. There are tasks where it makes sense, but there's a lot of tasks in legal where it does not make sense, where reasoning and step-by-step work is so important.
Yeah, 100%. I noticed that you did your own webinar recently with one of my good friends, Elliot, and some other esteemed colleagues from the legal tech space. And I don't know, I wasn't able to join it live, but I sort of watched some of the recording. I mean, you published it, so I'm sure it's not Chatham House rules or anything else. Was there anything, any snippets from in there that you could share with us in terms of, because it was all about use cases. It was about real world use cases, what people are using, what are the firms using, anything that jumped out at you as a standout point or a theme, really?
I think there's a few themes that emerged from that conversation. I'll kind of tell you how we got into that conversation and what we got out of that conversation. So that was actually the second webinar I've ever hosted. The first one was about, okay, let's dispel some of the crazy claims that are going out there. Like people saying, there are no hallucinations anymore, we can solve it. No. Sorry, that's not actually doable today. And then after that, someone emailed me and said, yeah, that's great, you went through an hour of kind of like talking about and dispelling these myths, but you didn't tell us a single use case. And I was like, didn't we? Maybe we did, maybe we didn't, but let's host a webinar. Let's grab some law firms. Let's grab an industry expert and let's talk about actual use cases inside of law firms. And so that's what led to the webinar. And for me, there's a couple of takeaways. First takeaway is if you look at what Elizabeth, Elliot, and Conan were saying, and also Christian, every firm has a different stage in the journey. And I would say the Attleshaw Goddards of the world is so far along their journey compared to a lot of the other firms that are out there. But pretty much everyone admits that they're still in the experimentation stage. Mm. Like they haven't found that killer use case, whatever that is. And what they found are kind of two categories of use cases. One are the little conveniences, the lubricants in your day-to-day work, where you can have an email like Copilot for Microsoft that would summarize an email for you or draft an email back that would be in the right tone, and you can use that as your first draft. Okay, great. That's a lubricant. Mm-hmm. And then there are the sort of like really small, discrete end-to-end use cases, and Elliot went through a few of those for specific experts and teams that want to streamline certain tasks. So extract out all of these things, put it into a table where you couldn't have done it before because just the machine wasn't quite sophisticated enough. So those are kind of the categories of use cases that came out. And I think Elizabeth put it really nicely, where she said that they found three categories that are really useful. Summarizing is one, because Gen AI is really good at transforming like data, transforming text from one form to another. Extracting, so going through a large block and then pulling out bits of information that make sense. And the third was doing first drafts, like creatively make something up. And what's interesting about that is none of those are end-to-end use cases. All of those are in the lubricant cap. And I think it's the sort of evolution of you need to give it to users, and this is kind of product research 101. Find out what they're doing with it, then go, oh, if you keep doing that and you keep wanting to do that, maybe we can productize it. Mm. Maybe this is something that we can build into what Elliot talked about, which is specific to that practice team that can do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So that's a summary. There's a lot more detail in the webinar itself, so please go ahead and watch it. But that's a summary of what people talked about.
Yeah, watch it after you've listened to this, definitely. But watch.
Oh yeah. Don't stop now.
Of course.
Don't nuggets. There's to more be had good right
stuff.
Now.
There's more good stuff. But I think it's really, you describe it as the little lubricants, and I think that's really telling, because if you start to, from my world where you think about sort of end-to-end processes, orchestrating sort of, I don't know, contract remediation or whatever it might be, and you go, well, actually, there's like 100 significant steps to this to get from point A to point Z, and that's 26, but you know what I mean, 100. I was never good at maths. But you sort of, you look at it and you go, okay, well, actually, I need that to do that bit for here. And I need to do it again in three steps time, but for a different purpose. Yep. And I think that's why I think that you almost won't have a product, if that makes sense. It'll just be a thing that happens at a point in time, and somebody won't even know that they've drafted a document that's got this XYZ because it's been programmed, it's been productized. And I think that's the future. The future is either products that vendors are building that do a thing that don't even call it AI. It's just a thing, and it's just using this newfangled type of technology. Or law firms, in our case, but corporates, wherever, building bits of technology. Because as you said earlier, it's all open source. If you've got a smart enough team, you could be building this stuff yourself. You know what I mean? So you sit there and go, okay, well, Is that perhaps one of the directions for some of the firms who are more advanced, or firms that want to skip that learning and just go, actually, you know, why don't we just build something and go off and do something? And not just a ChatGPT interface type scenario, but actually bake it into a product, make it real as such, but not sort of, I think I'm crying out for the point, and it's almost like, remember when innovation was a dirty word like 5 years ago when everyone was talking about innovation? I crave for the day where this new wave of innovation And what innovation means is now more rounded and accepted and everything else. I want Gen AI to go through that cycle of it's too noisy, it's crazy, da 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 da. And actually now it's got its place, and it's not the be all and end all, but it's an important part of what we do. And I think I can't wait for that point. But I mean, it's a journey, isn't it? It's like everyone thinks, as you said, you were talking about agentive AI and sort of bringing out sort of it mapping out things itself. And you sort of sit there and go, we haven't even sorted out the first bit yet. We haven't even sorted out our business processes before Gen AI yet, or whatever. So it's like, I think sometimes there's tech for tech's sake, and we're all running at 1,000 miles an hour, and perhaps a little bit more of a coastal speed is something that firms need to take a step back and have a think about. Right, we're not going to use. We're not going to say AI anymore. We're not going to say anymore. We're going to.
Oh, let me say. Let me say one thing about AI, and then we'll move on.
Thing you've ever said. Go on. No pressure.
So the only thing, the smartest thing I'll ever say about AI, and here you go. Mark this moment in time. is law firms have never really had an R&D function. They don't spend money on R&D like other organizations. They've got money on KM. And I think for the very first time in the history of legal services, people realize, oh crap, we can have an R&D function, but because no one's really done it before, they're treating R&D as if it's a function that's meant to productionize what they're finding. Yeah. No, it's a different department. Once you've done R&D, you've got a report, you hand it off to a different team, and then they go, right, how do we adopt this? How do we transform this? How do we do stuff with it? Don't just grab something out of beta and go, all right, everybody, here you go. Now you guys figure out how to use it. Like this is, I think, the biggest kind of hiccup right now, where law firms have necessarily gotten R&D functions these days, but they're just not using it the way that more mature organizations are using it.
So that's
the smartest thing I'll ever say.
Well, but that leads on to other things. So we sort of, and I said that we wouldn't talk about Gen AI. Let's talk about technology in general. But you hear firms, and that point around R&D is typically where you're producing something, you're building something, and you're how that will get put into your organization or how you'll take it to market. And I think typically law firms buy something, give it to their lawyers and go, right, done, next project, next one, done, next project, and on to the next one. And I think that one of the good things that our current cycle is doing for firms is encouraging them to think differently, to think about how they can adopt different technology and what it means and how they experiment with things. And what does experiment mean? Does it mean buy it and see? Does it mean spend 6 months reviewing it and then handing it over to another team, as you describe? And I think that maturity is really interesting. And I think one of the points I've noticed over the last sort of 5-6 months of chatting with people is sort of since COVID and like lockdowns and everything else, COVID woke firms up of all sizes, law firms, corporates, whatever, because they suddenly realized they had to work remotely. They suddenly went, right, shit, we've got to do Teams, we've got to do this, we've got to do whatever, Zoom or another sort of remote working platform. This isn't an advert for anyone. But they had to adapt ways of working and what they were doing and how they worked. And I think the pace at which some firms, and you talk about Adelsheim as being one of the front runners of adopting Gen AI technology, is that there are firms that do wait, but there are firms now that are really pushing that whole view that law firms are laggards. They wait until the bottom end of the hockey stick and then they start to adopt technology, and they're never early adopters. They never go through this process. Now, there are some, and there are people that will look at me and go, oh, Ben, that's very naughty. But ultimately, as an industry, that's what we are. We operate in a highly regulated, compliant environment with rules, regulations, and all that sort of stuff. So we have to be careful. But I think since COVID, that whole change in mindset is driving these new ways of working. And I think without it, I don't think we would have seen the current adoption of Gen AI if we hadn't. And so I think that's one of those things that you start to look at trends in terms of corporations and mindsets post COVID. And I think Gen AI has benefited from it because it's like, oh, we could do that, so we could do this. And everyone's now talking about it. So let's see how it goes. I don't know. It was just an observation, not even a question.
No, it's I have jokes that I can make about thanking vampire bats. I think you're absolutely right that COVID did kind of shift what people's attitude was towards transformation, because they realized we can do this. And I think like it's a really good lesson that yes, when the circumstances compel you to, you can absolutely transform and overcome any kind of challenges and obstacles. I also think that it changed the way that people perceived the role of technology, in that like technology used to be, okay, it's a convenience, it used to fall in a couple of buckets. It was the Microsoft Office suite and your DMS and your billing tool. Those are your essentials. Everything else,
keeping the lights on.
And everything else was a bonus. I think COVID kind of taught people to go, oh no, there's keeping the lights on, and then there's kind of the efficiency boost. There's the stuff that takes you from a highly manual process to something that can scale, to something that brings you out of the Stone Ages into the industrial age. And I think it's only been 4 or 5 years since then. I don't even know when COVID was anymore. And I think people are still kind of getting acclimatized to, okay, exactly what tech falls in what bucket. And so oftentimes there's a sort of a misconception to go, oh no, Gen AI is a must have. It's like, really? Really? tell me more about that. And I think like what I've seen out there a lot is people forget about the use case. And they forget that during COVID, you need a communication, so you sign up to Zoom. Okay, that's a use case. You needed that to solve a problem. But Gen AI having a chatbot that brings you back data, you already have search tools, and lawyers are paid to read. Like, that's just I'm trying to take shortcuts here, mischaracterizing the tool.
Yeah, I've said it before. If you'd have given a chatbot to a lawyer 3 years ago, they'd have looked at you and gone, okay, what? Why do I need this? Oh, it's going to give me some information if I ask it some questions. So there was this, what was really interesting to me was that there was this sort of really negative view of chat interfaces, real-time respondents. You go to your airline website, whatever, and it goes, hi, my name's X. Can I help you book a flight? And it's like, no, go away. You're going to make it more difficult. And it's like, that's the kind of, but that just went away. It's really easy to talk to a thing in a thing, and it's like, yeah, but what? Why are you doing that? And it's like, yeah, it's one of those things that sort of surprises me.
I think I want to make a clarification here, and that is, what I just said is not a critique of large language model technology. I think that technology itself has an incredible promise. It's a critique of the chatbot sort of user interface. And it's the kind of like, this was never a dominant user interface before in business. How did that suddenly become the primary go-to?
Because
it's really easy. Thank you.
It's just easy. I mean, there are shit interfaces and there are bad there are good chat interfaces and there are terrible ones, but you know, it's like, yeah, it's just easy. It's just, it's sort of, oh, somebody's going to reply to me. Oh, hello, Ben. Nice to meet you. So I don't know.
Are we old? Are we? Is this old. Like the principal Skinner thing?
I am definitely old. But that's you're not old. You're not definitely not old. I'm old and not wise, and you're young and wise. That's the way I think about it.
I don't think you know how old I am, but that's okay. Let's just keep it a mystery for the audience.
So I think maybe now's a good time to move away and talk about something that
bigger things.
And I think sort of we're both sort of kindred spirits, I think, because we both have very similar kind of organizational structures. We operate fully remote. We have teams in different countries. We have clients in different countries. And I think one of the things that sort of you talked about it earlier, but as a CEO of a business, you care about two things: happy clients and happy employees, and making sure that sort of people are good. So how do you do that? I know how we do it, but from a startup world where you are remote and you are doing stuff, how do you build a culture, or cultivate a culture, or encourage a culture that is something that you probably was relatively easy if you all sat in the same office and 5-6 years ago was happening? You know what I mean? How do you approach it? What are your tactics? Tactique is not even a word. A tactic or technique.
It's like, this is a fancy way of saying tactics. I like it. Tactiques.
Yeah.
So our tactiques really just come down to one single word, which is communication. It sounds so simplistic, but like both for customers and for employees, it's to facilitate an environment, a sort of atmosphere where people can feel comfortable telling you the deepest, darkest secrets. I say that jokingly, but also not jokingly. Yeah. If your customers are happy to tell you your product is a piece of crap, then you've got a chance to fix it before a renewal comes along. If your employees are happy to say to you, oh, I wasn't quite happy with this, you've got a chance to fix it before they resign. And so facilitating an environment where people are happy to just talk to you, that they feel not threatened, they feel like, you know, it's in everyone's best interest to work on this, pull in the same direction, be a team, whether it's with your employees or with your customers. That's what I want to facilitate. And I don't think that's different whether it's remote or not remote. I think like remote makes it harder because you can't demonstrate by example as much. But you can still do it. You can openly state, like, here, let me tell you my deepest, darkest secrets. So I recently had a conversation with a customer where I said during part of the monthly catch-up, look, we recognize that for one specific process where you want to go from zero to the output, it's 17 steps in the UX. And I literally said to him, the group, it's a miracle we have any customers at all with 17 steps in the UX. And thank you for putting up with us. But we're going to cut that down to 5 steps by doing X, Y, and Z. And we recognize it and thank you. I think by volunteering that, which is probably stuff they already know, but probably have never really documented the way we've documented it, it puts us on the same side. Now it's like, okay, we're going to work on this together. And the same for the team. I would say to the team, look, this account, we're probably going to lose it. And it's because we've got these competitors bidding for it. We don't have this one feature that they really, really wanted. So we're going to have to put up with that. But let's all focus on how to keep everyone else happy. Let's focus on, do we need that feature or not? Is that core to what we're doing? Everybody, let's come to an agreement. Then we pull in the same direction. So bring people with you. Communicate. Share the ups and the downs.
Yeah, 100%. I think that the journey's a really important one, because strategically, as a CEO, you've got your strategy, you've got your vision, you know the direction of travel. It takes a team to bring that together, but ultimately it's down to you to determine where, what, how fast, how aggressive, whatever it might be. But I think you are on that journey together, and I think there is a class of customer that I sort of describe as not a customer at all, really. They are customers and they pay for a service, but you embed yourself in part of their life as part of their team. You're an extension of their organization. Not because you're providing professional services, but because you have tried really hard to build those relationships for them to see that it isn't a traditional transactional kind of experience. It's, I want to add value. I want to charge you for this, but I want to add value with this. And I want to make sure that we're doing the best job possible. There are some customers that don't like that. There are some customers that will wrap that up and smother you until you can't breathe. But I think they're the kind of experiences with customers that we, as a customer person, that we crave for. We love those kind of engagements and those kinds of things. I think from an employee perspective, I think you're right. Remote does make it harder, but it is still possible. People do sort of do that. That whole building of a culture, particularly what's interesting is that I don't know if you've got any viewpoints on sort of when you started or when you had sort of more than two of you type thing in the world, you were onboarding new people and sort of that process of onboarding and sort of selling them the vision and the mission, which you probably did as part of the hiring process, but sort of embedding that and doing that remotely now is much harder than sort of wrapping an arm around the shoulder and sort of going, you're day one, come on, let's go for an experience of this, we'll take you for lunch. It's a very different kind of world. And I think I agree, it is still possible, but it's like there are challenges with it. Communication, 100% communication is king, let's just say.
It is absolutely king.
So where, oftentimes there is no fixed audience for this podcast in any way, shape or form. I'll get any audience from wherever I can get it. But I think one of the things that somebody said to me a couple of weeks ago was that sounds like some of the topics that you'll be talking about are aimed at founders or startups or scale ups or whatever it might be. I said, well, not really intentionally, but maybe sort of. And so this question is really, really about sort of understanding sort of inspiration. So you're not allowed to say customers, but what's your inspiration? When do you wake up and you go, right, we're gonna do whatever it is. Do you read? Yep. Where do you take and process ideas from, and how does that quite transform into your business?
It's a really interesting question. So not allowed to say customers, which I think is
harsh. It's harsh.
Oh no, it's fair. It's fair because like it's a sort of standard answer, but right? Let's get more nuanced about it. Look, for me, like my driver in life, one of the things I really love and it's what inspires me is to create something from nothing. It's a process of creation that I derive the most joy from, which is why, you know, I started a company because you create so many things in a company. Could have been an artist, Ben. Could have been an artist. Like that's what kind of drives a lot of what I do. And in terms of where I get the inspirations from to go and create stuff and do stuff, it's really by observing everything in the world. And it could be really big things, like you go and read a book, a new book that someone's recommended to you. Like I saw a YouTube video, Gary Tan at Y Combinator talking about a sales book that you should read, and I forget the name of the book, but it's on a video. And it's like, okay, I can go and read that and get ideas and change processes and create something from there. Or it could be little things like I was saying earlier, taking the kid to the playground and then going, oh, that's an interesting design for X, whatever that is. And then going, maybe I can do that. Well, that's an interesting color. Like, do you think that color stands out? It's like all these little things that can happen as well. So it's, yeah, I think my wife hates it because I'm always kind of half switched off. But
always listening, but pretending not to listen. I like it. I like it.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. But no, it's kind of like taking inspiration and trying to leave a legacy behind, trying to leave a legacy that has a positive impact on people, not mentioning customers, of course. And yeah, that for me is just the thing, just watching and looking and
not in a creepy way.
Be useful.
Not in a creepy way.
You know those parks that have a sign that says adults must be accompanied by children?
Yeah. Like
that's, yeah.
Not in a creepy way. So you've just described sort of almost everything being a source of inspiration, which is that's really cool. And I think my brain doesn't operate like that. It's just not capable. If I see something that's green, I look at it and go, oh, that's green. I don't think about the influence of that green on something else. I just go, oh, okay, that's fine. That's brain's computed it.
It's not like I'm switched on, by the way. Like this is very, very rarely. I'm talking like once a year on my birthday.
Yeah. So I used to say when I used to work at Haikyuu, I haven't said it recently, but I used to say that I was limited to one good idea a month. And I'd usually get that good idea on the first or the second of the month, and I could just relax. Literally, I would relax and then I'd have the next one. Month done. Wait for the paycheck. but I think probably like me, how you've got you're a CEO, you're always thinking, you're putting others and your customers first. How do you, well, there's two questions here. How do you make sure that you create time for you and your family without the stresses of burnout and all the other crazy stuff? And then the second part of that question is, if you don't answer it in the way that I think you might answer it, I will come back with the second part.
Okay. Okay. Look, I'm definitely not very good at like balance. So what I have, and it helps with everything, is a very forceful wife who says you must take your evenings and weekends off. And very thankfully, I have an extremely competent team who, when I say I can't do this, I'm passing it on to you, please, as I gracefully delegate whatever it is I have to move on, they can carry it forward. Like this morning, our lead engineer messaged me because he had taken the day off and he said, we finished it, and he didn't have to do anything. I was like, tick. That's delegating on the delegation.
Yeah,
well done. And so it's like it's building a team that can handle these sorts of things, and also having someone to constantly remind you that cramping pain you're feeling in your back, it's because you haven't eaten since morning. It's like, oh, okay, yep, I'm just gonna go and grab some food then. and so that's how I keep balance.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I think that's sort of I think you're right. You need a strong partner, human thing in your life that's going to keep you in check. My wife has been doing that for, I don't know, a very long time. 1990.
She's put up with you. I mean, oh, that's...
Jesus. She deserves she deserves something. Probably not to be with me, quite frankly. But I think that's always the thing, and you always find I don't recognize the telltale signs when I have hit the wall, and the wall might happen once a week, once a day, once a month, until I realize that I've hit the wall because I'm getting told off. Like I've just been short with one of the kids because they're kicking a ball against the wall or something like that. And it's like, well, actually they're kids, so they should be able to do that. But you know, there's that balance. I think everyone needs a good solid wife or partner or everything else.
So what's the second part of the question? What was
the second part? So the second part is that I have too much to do in my day job, and you probably have too much to do in your day job. How do you keep track of everything? And you've sort of answered it because you've got a great team, you delegate out, and I've got a great team and I delegate some things out. But there are some things that you collect because you can't really delegate it because you're breaking new ground or you're doing something different or new, and you selfishly want your spin on it or whatever it might be. How do you track and manage all of the spinning plates that you're spinning so that you don't forget about one? What's your trick? Do you have a trick?
I'll tell you what I do. I'm not sure it's a trick, but it's something that was taught to me by a life coach or career coach. And that is I keep a Trello board. And the Trello board has it's supposed to have only 4 columns, but I've made it 6 columns. And the 4 columns are what I have to do this week, what I have to do this month, what I have to do whenever. Doesn't matter. There's no time priority. So it's only 3 columns. Wow, I've made it 6 columns. I've doubled it. Whereas I keep a yearly goal as the first column. So not just what I have to do this week, but what's a yearly goal. And also what I've completed this month and what I completed last month as 2 archive goals. And that way I can remind myself, one, of, oh yeah, pat myself on the back. I'm not a loser. I've done some things, and also keep my eyes on the prize. In addition to actually like managing the tasks that have to be done. But to your point, like there's a lot that slips between the crack. The column for the whenever tasks, I think it's a few hundred tickets now. Like that's a lot. I don't think it's ever meant to be that size. And eventually I kind of like, once every 6 months, go through and go, okay, well, that's never happening. Drag that to a column, make it red. It's not going to happen. And just kind of reminding myself, going to look at that list once or twice a day.
Well, I should do something like that. I have multiple lists, paper, email. I've got a sort of an equivalent of a Trello board, but I don't have a standard way, and I think I should have a standard way. That would be good.
Yeah, well, I'll share my template with you. Adopt it if you use it, and
that'd be awesome. We could share it with the group. You know,
I would not share my screen right now because you'll see all my.
Not the screen, but the columns, the ideas, the theory behind it.
Yeah. So first column, yearly mission. Second column, things I have to do this week. Third column, things I have to do this month. Fourth column, whenever, doesn't matter. Just things you have to do. Fifth column, what I've achieved this month. Sixth column, what I achieved last month. And then once, you know, every month you cycle, you just rotate. Archive.
Awesome. No, thank you for that. That's a great takeaway.
You're welcome.
So we're almost at time. One of these things I said at the very beginning, the wonders of technology allow us to do this sort of thing. But, you know, there's nothing quite like sharing a beer or just a high five or a hello. Yes. So when will I see you next, Horace? You're going to come to London? You're going to come to the Isle of Wight? You should come to the Isle of Wight if you ever come to the UK. If not, Ilta?
So probably Ilta. I don't get to travel much these days on account of two very young monsters. But I do want to make a trip later this year. A friend of mine's getting married in Shanghai, so I figured New York to London, London to Shanghai, Shanghai to Sydney, and then back again. It's a very ambitious trip. It may or may not happen. It really depends on like how ready I am to let things go for 2 whole weeks. yeah, it's a big milestone for me. It's the first. Well, first holiday I would have taken in 6 years. So we'll see if that happens. But pending that, Ilticon is where we're going to share a couple of beers.
Awesome. Perfect. Horace, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for being so honest and open. And I will see you very soon, young man. Keep well and take it easy.
Thank you, Ben. Looking forward to seeing you soon.
See you later. Take it easy.